Recorded live in downtown Newtown, this is Rancho Notorious, a podcast about movies and other cool stuff. You can find this and all the other episodes of the show at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious. Welcome everybody to season 2 episode number 1 of Rancho Notorious. This is a milestone, ladies and gentlemen. Here we are, season 2. Even though our season length is completely arbitrary. So
no, you know, I planned it on purpose so I could be back here, Dan.
Indeed. Okay, so Kaylee chooses how long the seasons are in order to entirely suit whatever symbolism she needs.
It's a Mayan goddess.
Yeah. My name is Dan Slevin, and here with me in Wellington, in person, amazingly,
it's Kaylee.
Hi, Kaylee.
Hi.
Back from her gallivanting around the globe.
Indeed. Going to film festivals, telling you all about film festival films. It was hard work.
And here we are, and you've come back, and you've brought the summer with you.
Well, yeah, today. The day after I landed, it wasn't so great, but yes.
So this is kind of ridiculous, actually, that here we are in Rancho Notorious, and because we started in the middle of winter, I had no idea that when we record at this time of the evening, the sun would be pouring into this room. We've had to close the curtains because we can't see what we're doing.
There was no plan.
This is Wellington. Whoever plans for a sunny day in Wellington? I mean, that's just crazy stuff. All right. Also with us here in the flesh, as it were, we have Anthony S. Pratt, one of our esteemed executive producers.
Yay!
Now, I'm just going to ask, are you Anthony S. Pratt as an executive producer because that's what's on your credit card?
Yes. I certainly wouldn't call myself that name.
So you've let us credit you for 18 episodes at the end of every episode as Anthony S. Pratt.
But all my friends and my colleagues think it's really funny.
Well, it is, obviously.
Yeah.
But I've known you for, let's think about this now, 14 years.
14 or 15 years
as Tony Pratt. So welcome to Rancho Notorious. It's a pleasure to have you here. Before we get into the main body of the show, as it were, can you just maybe let people know what you do for a day job without giving? I mean, obviously, you're completely prevented from giving away any like real details about anything real. But what's you've got a business card or something. Well, you can tell people what you do, right?
Yeah. So I'm basically on Her Majesty's Secret Service, and. You don't believe me, do you?
No.
Oh, God.
No.
I work at Park Road Post Production, so in the industry, as it were. And, look after pretty much everything that comes through in my own little way.
And everything that goes through Park Road Post is basically top secret, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. Except that there's a film...
Until it's out, and then we get to celebrate it.
Right.
Yeah.
Except that we do know that there's a film full of short people that's about to come out a little bit of time. So I'm amazed, frankly, that you're not basically burning the candle at both ends to get this...
I've got a three-sided candle. Two of them are burning. This one's for you.
And he... Beautiful.
Oh, yeah. I actually have a question.
Okay.
Do you guys do the safety videos?
No, I wish we did. And it's funny, every time one of those comes out, I want to make one. And I would love to have done that one with Taika, because like Taika's just really cool.
The best part was the flight attendants running into battle throwing lollies. Like, that was the best.
Don't you want to do that?
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine there's going to be all these lollies thrown on New Zealand planes? They're going to spend so much money cleaning the planes, they're going to regret the video. Yeah. It's awesome.
I think, I suspect that they regret those videos fairly early on in the piece, actually.
But they had a teeny tiny Elijah Wood.
See, not all of us get to fly as often as you guys. So I haven't seen it yet, and I'm not one of those people
it's
that
on
go.
The internet.
I know, but in the same. I know,
don't
but
tell.
Like chocolate milk and various other fads, I don't, you know, stop what I'm doing and go looking
chocolate
for.
Chocolate milk is not a fad. That's a necessary part of one's diet.
Have you tried it?
Yeah.
Is it good?
Yeah.
Is it worth queuing for 3 hours?
Hell no. It's ridiculous.
All right. Today's show, I think I announced this through the Twitter feed a little bit earlier on, but we've got so much content for the first episode of season two that we're going to split it into two parts. Okay, it's epic. The first bit, and that's the bit that you're listening to now, obviously, is the more time-sensitive stuff, the stuff that we need to get out before the weekend. Oh, that's right. I printed on both sides of it. I'm looking at the script and going, that makes no sense whatsoever. Oh, that's right. It's on the head. Okay, so that's coming out on Friday as usual. Part two, we're going to save for after the weekend and get that to you sometime on Monday. Of course, if you're listening, if you've discovered us on iTunes and it's 2015, this is going to ignore all of this. It makes sense to us here at the time, okay? But anyway, what have we got content-wise? In part one, this one, I interview British pop star and actor Martin Kemp about the new film biography of his band Spandau Ballet. The film is called Soul Boys of the Western World, and there's a special one-off screening of that on Saturday night in Auckland. Toa Fraser's newest feature film, and I can say newest feature, isn't it amazing to have a New Zealand director who you can say his newest feature film, mm-hmm. like they get to make more than one, and he gets to make one a year. Brilliant. The Deadlands opens today, that's Thursday, in New Zealand, all over the place, and I spoke to him yesterday about that film and the career that he's definitely enjoying. That's also in part one. And in part one, we will also, Kaylee and I, review the comedy called This Is... Have I got the title right? I can't even remember whether I've got the title. Is it called This Is Where I Leave You?
Yes.
So unmemorable, the entire thing. Anyway.
True story.
Yeah. In part two, we'll do the news, which will be just ridiculously out of date by Monday, but we hope still vaguely entertaining. Tony and I are going to review Brad Pitt in a Tank in Fury, and I speak to the director of the Show Me Shorts Film Festival, Gina Della Barca, about this year's festival and how cool it is, and how cool it is that there's a cinema in Stewart Island now, which I think we should do a remote Rancho Notorious on the road. We should take it on the road.
We need to time it during like the Bluff Oyster Festival, though.
Oh, yes.
Bring it. Bring it. Absolutely. All of that, plus the usual plethora, did I write that, of news, stats, and opinion, etc. But first up, Kaylee, what's in the mail bag?
We have a lovely collection of tour reviews this week, starting with the Mirka. I don't think we've had a tour review from them.
No, he's doing something. He's doing something really interesting on Twitter at the moment. And well, it's interesting, you know, if your definition of interesting is as broad as mine is, but he's a really big Fleetwood Mac fan, and he's going to see Fleetwood Mac on his next overseas trip. And so he's basically tweeting his top 40 Fleetwood Mac songs, counting down till the time he gets to go and see them. So one a day, his top 40 Fleetwood Mac songs. So I mean, this is a
How
guy.
How many songs does Fleetwood Mac have?
They were around for a long, long time.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. The Mirka's two-word review for A Most Wanted Man, Hoffman Heartbreak. His loss is still too much to bear.
Yep.
Fred Thompson sent in a plethora of two-word reviews this week. Two-word review.
A plethora.
Plethora. Two-word review for Whiplash, Sensory Overload. Teller is fantastic, but J.K. Simmons makes mental intimidation to another level. Takes mental intimidation to another level. Brilliant. And also two-word review for Best of Me, Fluffy Balderdash. Wait, that sets the standard for season two right there. Follows the typical Sparks recipe of a contrived narrative served with lots of cheese.
All right. We got another comment on the website.
Yeah.
I know. This is like, that's the moment you pop corks of champagne. So Mark Rogers... Yeah, well done.
Nice.
Good. Yeah, you're a professional post-production person here.
You.
Mark Rogers, he's written an essay here, but first of all, he wanted to point out to Kaylee, Fire Walk With Me wasn't made for TV. It was actually released in cinemas, and he saw it at the Lido back in the day.
So I saw it at the King Charles in London.
Right, so that was back, refers back to our discussion about Twin Peaks from a few episodes ago.
Well, I was lied to then.
Yeah.
I was in cinema.
That's episode 17 of season one, Guilty as Charged. And he does go into some detail about his love for Twin Peaks and how worried he is about the about it coming back, which is all totally fair enough. So please remember, if you've got longer than 140 characters that you want to express to us, then go to the website and leave a comment, because we love hearing from you.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Is that about it?
That's about it.
Well, there was also a discussion on my Twitter feed from various people. I'm just trying to remember what it was. I remember looking at this afternoon and thinking, oh, that was interesting. We should probably talk about that. And now I can't remember what it was. Oh, that's it. It was talking about people talking in movies, which is a fairly common...
Oh, don't even get me started.
Well, here's the thing, right? Here's the thing. I went to see Fury at the Embassy on Monday night, and the lights went down, the trailers finished, and the film started, and there were some people talking behind me. So I turned around and said, dude, the film started. And they shut up. And they stayed shut up for the entire film. I am a golden god.
You are.
Yes.
Caca.
So, but that, I tweeted that joke, so if you've heard it before, I apologize. But we got quite a lot of feedback from people about talking in movies, and it went on to people talking in concerts and how annoying that is. Gigs.
People singing along really badly.
Well, at least they're kind of enjoying it. But talking as if they're not listening to the music, that's just bananas. I've been to a few things in Wellington at smaller concert venues like San Fran and Bodega, where people, it's like they're just the regulars at the bar at the back. And I went to a gig at the San Fran, which was this beautiful acoustic sort of Americana thing, and of course in the quiet moments all you can hear is the glasses clinking as they come in and out of the dishwasher, and then they turn the blender on to blend the ice for the, you know, it's like, oh dear god, do you people care about music at all? Anyway, back to...
We digress.
We do. Well, we love to digress. And yeah, talking of digressions...
That's why we have a podcast.
Exactly. Yeah. Don't like our digressions? Get your own podcast. Kaylee, what have people been watching at the movies?
Oh, in at number 5, all the way down from number 1, Annabelle. Oof, crashing in its third week.
Crashing and burning.
In at number 4, opening at number 4, Happy New Year.
I think it's Bollywood.
Ah.
Yep.
Ooh, nice. In the top 5.
Yep.
In at number 3, up from 6, is Pride.
Which I saw something the other day which said opens today. Like, for today. And it's like, so have those weeks been previews? No, this has been open, right? For 2 weeks. Actually open. Yeah. Okay, so I think that one cinema in Wellington, who we are both intimately acquainted with, got their ads wrong. I think that's probably what it is. Yeah, you know, one that we both worked for.
Hey man, it's a difficult job doing those advertisements.
I know, you used to do it.
It's taxing.
Yeah, but you set a standard that, you know, it's just so hard to...
Hey man, don't even. They are lovely people. Okay, sitting at number two is Gone Girl.
And Gone Girl just could never crash number 1, could never make it, did it? It's like, couldn't make it on opening week. It's just been sitting there at number 2.
I'm telling you people, it's worth going to. Get it to number 1. Let's do it. In at number 1 this week, opening at number 1, is Fury, which we are going to talk about in the second episode.
In part 2, yeah.
So you're just going to have to hold your horses.
Exactly. All right, so what's going on over the ditch? The Cousins in Australia, number 5, Walk Among the Tombstones, holding its own very much there in week number 2. Tammy, which didn't even bother getting a release here in New Zealand, probably for the best for those of us that actually watch films for a living. Number 3, This Is Where I Leave You, talking about that in part 1 of the show. Gone Girl at number 2 and Fury at number 1.
Now, before I start the US box office, I will say that my parents did request North American box office.
Oh, that requires math. Because Canada's sort of separated out. We should do Canada as a separate thing.
We should. Yeah. We should. We do have a lot of listeners.
Unlike
in
the UK box office, which for some reason includes Malta.
Yeah.
Yeah, the US don't include Canada.
Yeah, but the whole time, I totally thought US and Canada had the same release dates, but they don't. It's different.
Well, no, presumably they have separate school holidays, and you know, there's all sorts of different reasons why they might do that.
Yeah, so I was like, oh.
Or anyway, they're just being ornery.
Maybe. In at number five, The Book of Life, which I'm so looking forward to seeing.
Remind me what that one is.
That is the animated feature about the Dia de los Muertos. And
Oh, yeah. You told me about that last week. Yeah, okay.
In at number
I'm going to ask you every week what that one is.
Has Channing Tatum in it as the voice?
Oh, okay.
In at number four.
Your mate Channing Tatum from BFF. Telluride.
Oh, I was like, why did I sit on the other side of the room? I could have been so close to his abs. Damn it. things you regret in life. In at number four, Gone Girl. Three, Fury. Number two, John Wick.
Sorry, interesting. Fury, number one in Australia and New Zealand, but second week dropping very quickly. So, yeah, maybe not getting the word of mouth that they would hope.
In second place, John Wick.
That's Keanu Reeves channeling Liam Neeson, apparently. in one of those hard man, tough, hard-boiled, violent thriller things.
And in at the number one position, Ouija.
You're going to have to explain this one to me because I looked at that and
prepared.
What the heck? What in tarnation?
So for those listeners who are familiar with Ouija boards, perhaps you pronounce it differently. That's how I pronounced it. Ouija board is a Hasbro game that apparently you can speak with the other side using... Oh, there I am. Speak with the other side using this Ouija board, and it moves on its own. So they've decided to make a movie out
Sorry,
of it.
Sorry, so the Hasbro game. But the pieces move on their own.
Well, everyone puts their hands on it, and they ask questions, and it says yes or no or spells things out, but apparently it works on its own. But
batteries not included.
Obviously, there's someone in the group pushing it and lying about it.
No.
So I'll read you the storyline, which was written by Marco, which is on IMDb. A girl is mysteriously killed after recording herself playing with an ancient Ouija board, which leads to a close group of friends to investigate the board. They later find out that some things aren't meant to be played with, especially the other side.
Misses. Wow. I should.
That's so 50s.
Yeah. If I was a professional, I would be looking that up now on the New Zealand release date list to see if it was coming out here. I would say that with those, I mean, first of all, it's Hasbro, so chances are there's money behind it. So yes, probably. But also those sorts of horror movies do well here. So
yeah, maybe Ouija boards are going out of fashion and they really needed like a bump in sales.
Is it what they need to do is if they made a found footage Ouija board thing, like Paranormal Activity, the Ouija, that would be just like a license to print money.
The Ouija.
Okay.
So, yeah, there you go. Thanks, America, for that.
The rest of the English-speaking world. Now, we've just been told, Canada, we need to include them. Obviously, a much bigger market than the UK. So I will definitely remedy that for future episodes. But for now, in the UK, number five, The Maze Runner. This is last weekend's box office. Number four, The Book of Life. Three, Gone Girl, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which is printing money at a rate you would not believe in the UK. And number one, Brad Pitt and Fury. And just because they provide so much extra information on the BFI data, what have we got here that's kind of interesting? A Streetcar Named Desire, the NT Live is doing well there. I saw the posters for that. That looks really good with what's her face from the X-Files. Bjork still making money with Biophilia Live. This is really, it's a very, look, Maleficent at number 53, still making money in the UK. Look, pretty cool. What else have we got? Guardian Live, Russell Brand in conversation, £192. And next week, this is something we mentioned last week on the show, that in the UK they get these fantastic re-releases. Aliens is being re-released in the UK next week.
Yes.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, yes.
All right, and that's I was at an event on Monday afternoon where James Cameron was Skyped in from LA to talk about his Deepwater Expedition 3D movie, and did a big Q&A afterwards, and people queued up and lots of kids, and it was all very cute and what have you, but nobody asked them questions about the Terminator or Aliens at all, or even True Lies. Wasted opportunity. just it was all about water and fish and plankton and, you know, and two people asked him how much it cost and he wouldn't answer them. Anyway.
I heard it was also about him yelling at scientists.
Oh, the film is a little bit about that, yeah. But no. Oh, in the Q&A, he was just the salt of the earth. He was just beautiful, blissed out.
He wouldn't yell. He would be encouraging loudly.
But also, I was given permission, totally given permission by the publicity people to record that Q&A. So I'm wondering. I'm not sure if we'll be able to play it next week, but the week after. We'll have selected excerpts from that Q&A from the James Cameron one.
That's amazing.
And it's totally legit Rancho Notorious because Doug Dillerman, who's one of our regular sort of guest hosts, asked one of the questions. So it's just like us being there. Huh. Brilliant.
So meta.
So Spandau Ballet are one of the great favourite bands of mine. I went to see Spandau Ballet at Wembley Arena in 1984. Christmas. It was only the second big stadium gig that I'd been at. I went to see Paul Young earlier on that year, and it was like I went by myself on the tube and went to Wembley Arena and watched this gig, and I've been telling people this for 30 years now, 30 years since I went to this thing, that not only like Paul Young had lasers, right? Lasers, and I was like, oh, that was amazing, lasers and smoke, right? But Spandau Ballet had a video screen in 1984, which was pretty amazing. And not only do they have a video screen, but at one point in one of the songs, Steve Norman, the saxophone player, goes to the front of the stage, sits on the front of the stage, and they close up on him doing his saxophone solo. And if you look up at the big screen, a little animated parade of characters comes out of his saxophone. 1984, ladies and gentlemen, I've never seen anything so impressive. And It was a great gig. This was the period where Spandau Ballet, Duran Duran and Culture Club were all competing to put the most gigs on at Wembley Arena at Christmas time. It was insane. And they were just the big three because you also had the Thompson Twins and Orchestral Manoeuvres in the Dark. I mean, it was an absolute heyday for British pop music. Anyway, so when I got the opportunity to actually talk to Martin Kemp, who was the bass player of Spandau Ballet and went on to be an actor of some repute as well. Yeah, he and his brother Gary played the Cray Twins in that famous British film. Well, I was not going to do it, was I?
No.
Martin Kemp, welcome to Rancho Notorious.
Hey, thank you for having me, man.
It's a pleasure talking to you. You're here in New Zealand to promote Soul Boys of the Western World, which is a documentary about your band Spandau Ballet and the adventures that you guys got up to from the formation of the band in the late 1970s.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head there. It really, in some ways, it's an adventure movie. You know, for me, it's, you know, because it's about five guys starting off, five working class, poor guys starting off and on this incredible journey, you know. But a lot of people that have seen the film kind of, the film is more about our friendship in the band. And what the film does, I think, really well is it takes the band as a kind of the protagonist. And it lets you follow their journey, but then by following the journey of the band, lets you take a really good look at the 80s as well. So the 80s is documented just as much as the band.
Absolutely.
So what it does is, you know, even if you're not a fan of the band, then but you will still enjoy the movie.
The archive footage in the film is absolutely amazing. You guys seem to have cameras following you around before you'd even played a gig. Like,
I tell you the truth. You know, the whole film is archived. So there's no talking heads in the movie. It's all, you know, we narrate the movie, but it's all archived. So there was something like, by the time we put it all together, we gave it to the producer, director George Henkin, there was something like 300 hours of footage that she had to choose from. But the most important stuff, obviously, I felt, was at the beginning and the early stuff. But what happened was the very first wages that I got from the band, which was £60, given to me, excuse me, in the middle of a nightclub, I went out and bought a Super 8 camera. So we documented everything really early on.
And you mentioned that you're working class boys, but your working class childhood was a little bit more unusual than most because you went to a theatre school, so you had your eye on.
No, it was a theatre club. It was across the road from my house. It was two nights a week. It wasn't like a drama, a theatre school. It was my mum put me there not to become an actor, but to get rid of my incredible shyness that I had. So it was kind of like, it was more a kind of therapy than it was to turn me into an actor.
But you must have discovered something else about yourself in those classes.
I discovered, it brought me out of my shyness. I think what I discovered was that I was in love with charisma. People with charisma that you can't take your eyes off of. You know when there's two people on TV or on a movie and one of them's not saying anything, but they're the ones that you draw your attention. They're the ones that you're looking at, even though they're not the main person in the scene. You know, that's what I was in love with when I was a kid, like Bruce Lee and Marlon Brando and Elvis. It wasn't so much rock and roll. I think it was charisma.
Well, I was thinking watching the movie last night that, Spandau Ballet was never just one person or a vehicle for one person. You know, there's Tony's voice, there's Gary's songs, and then there's your smolder. You know, you certainly managed to make sure that sort of Marlon Brando charisma sort of came through when the camera was on you.
I think the best thing about the band is that we all have our different inputs. It's a kind of eclectic mix in a way of musical tastes as well. You know, we vary from John Keeble playing drums, loves heavy metal, and Steve Norman loves soul. And so it's kind of, my brother grew up loving Al Green. And so it's kind of, we all bring different things to the table, which kind of gives us our Spandau Ballet sound, I suppose.
And that Spandau Ballet sound evolved incredibly rapidly in the early 80s from the new romantic and electronic sort of keyboard stuff, which sort of got discarded fairly early on into really pure pop. What was the driving force behind that? Was it within the band or the producers that you started to work with?
No, it was never the producers, because it was always within whatever we've done musically has come from the band. You know, it's I think producers weren't. The producer we used were just kind of to record the band because, we were big on rehearsing in those days. So whatever we had, whatever we were taking into the studios, was pretty much done before we got there. You know, it was down to the producers to record it, but they would never kind of influence us in the way that we sounded. So the move away from that electronic, that kind of small German electronic pop sound into mainstream pop with True was our choice. I think that was us kind of growing up.
It was also the heyday of music video and big budget music video and the opportunity to play at being movie stars as well. And Spandau, you were very much at the forefront of those sort of narrative, story-driven music videos. Is that where you got this idea that you could make the leap to big screen acting?
No, I think what you mean is when me and Gary went into the craze, right? Well, that leap really came from me being at drama club when I was a kid, you know, because acting became part of me when I was 7 years old. It became part of my personality. So I think when it got to 1990 and, the band was running out of its sell-by date, as it were, you know, everything, the music was changing, the 80s were turning into the 90s, you know, and DJ culture was kind of taking the lead in the charts rather than songs from bands like Spandau and Duran and ABC. I think you know, I realised then that it was things were changing, and that when the Crater movie came to us and the producers came to us and said, "Would you like to do it?" I realised straight away that it was a springboard into the next part of my life. So, you know, it was kind of like a safety net in a way for me to go on and do other things.
Yeah, and you absolutely have. You're well established now as an actor in television and films. And do you still have your own production company?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, we make a few things. Yeah,
right. And you even stepped behind the camera in 2011 to direct a feature film called Stalker. And what was that experience like for you?
That's wonderful. You know, I mean. Directing's great for me because, you know, I do all these different things. I love... It's a chance to put all your hobbies into one big ball, you know, into one big bubble. You know, I love acting, I love music, I love drama, photography, and all of that could be squashed down into one ball that's called directing. So you get a chance to do all of them in one go. I loved it, absolutely. You know, I jump at the chance of doing the next one.
Yeah, is there anything, have you got plans, anything in development?
You know, I've just been offered a couple to do, but for the next year coming up, all of next year, we're going to be touring with Spandau Ballet around the world. So that's my priority at the moment. We've got the film out, Soul Boys of the Western World is out, we've got a new album out called The Story, and with three new tracks on it, and we're off on tour for the next year. So that kind of eats up my future plans for the time being.
Well, first question is: is that tour going to come to Wellington? Because that's where
absolutely. Listen, we're going to try and get everywhere. You know, absolutely try and get everywhere.
Fantastic. I can go back to my 1984 Wembley experience and relive it.
I will save you a special seat down the front, man.
All right. I've got one more question. And I was curious about this, and this goes back to the film, to Soul Boys of the Western World. And the sort of climax of the movie is the reunion, the 2009 reunion. Yeah. But that's quite a big gap between that and the film actually being released. Is that partly because of just how much archive material, or
I mean, it's absolutely that. There was so much archive material. I mean, we've been working on the film for, I would say, the last 3 years. You know, the idea of the film, I think, first came about because on the last tour in 2009, on that tour, we played a song called Round and Round. And on the backdrop, on the screen, the giant screen behind us, we used to show some of my old home movies. And we realized that the audience loved it so much that the idea of the movie came out of that, in a way.
And so how much you guys didn't direct the finished film, but I mean, how much influence did you all have to sign off on it individually?
We gave the film and the idea to George Henkin and the director, and we said, listen, you have to do it, you cut it, because otherwise, if we did it, you know, it would just turn out to be another piece of Spandau propaganda. You know, five boys doing it, it would be about how many you sold, how many people came to see the gigs. And I think because George did it, George is a woman, right? And I think because she did it, she gave it much more emotional content. You know, she made it a story about friendship, and which is why the film's going down so well, because it's... you don't have to be a big fan of Spandau to enjoy the film. There's a lot more other stuff in there than that. It's kind of, in a way, Spandau are used as the protagonist, and you follow Spandau, the boy's journey through the 80s. But doing that, you get a chance to look at the 80s. And it's a lovely piece of work.
And you're absolutely right. It's not Spandau Ballet propaganda. You guys are not shown in the best light always.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a very honest film, but that's exactly how I think it should be told. You know, not life isn't just about all ups, is it? You know, for anyone. And, you know, you have to see... I mean, we you know, us guys in the band, we're in a very privileged position. You know, we led an incredible life, but it's not all ups. There's tough times as well. So I'm glad the way the film's turned out, and I'm glad how honest it is for people to see. Excuse me.
I can't wait to see you guys when you come back to town with the full band. Martin Kemp, thanks very much for visiting with us here at Rancho Notorious.
No problem, man. And I will see you very soon. Anyway, I'll see you with the film premiere.
So Martin Kemp from Spandau Ballet, the film Soul Boys of the Western World, playing on Saturday night in Auckland. Martin Kemp will be there. Tony Hadley, the singer from Spandau Ballet, will also be there. They'll be doing a Q&A afterwards and presumably hanging out and signing stuff. If I had a T-shirt from that 1984 gig that was still actually intact, there wasn't more holes than actual T-shirt, I would be up there getting them to sign that. But anyway, lovely guy, and the film is, depending on the response to it, Madman tell me that they're either going to play a few more theatrical screenings just in that sort of alternative content method, or it'll be released on home video in time for Christmas. Toa Fraser, welcome to Rancho Notorious.
Thanks, Dad. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for taking the time out of... you must be one of the busiest men in Auckland right now.
Well, I'm having a good time, but one can't complain. But yeah, no, it is feeling a little bit crammed at the moment with play rehearsals and the release of the Deadlands.
Indeed.
International stuff.
Yeah, well, the Deadlands is the main reason for getting you on the show. It opens, we're recording this on a Wednesday, it opens tomorrow, Thursday, and, you know, all over the country. And we're in a position now with New Zealand feature films that there's been such riches this year that we might even be at risk of taking a fantastic film like The Deadlands for granted.
I don't know. Well, I hope not. You know, certainly I'm really proud to be part of a, you know, really golden year. Kind of saw it coming, you know, 6 months ago or something, but... you know, really fantastic, and real. You know, I had a little bit to do with Dark Horse, so I was really, really thrilled to see that come to fruition. And I thought what Taika did with what we do in the Shadows was just incredible.
Mm.
Not only the movie, but the you know, the fun stuff around it.
Absolutely, and both those films have done really good business as well, which has not always been the case for even great New Zealand films.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what it says about us, but you know, it's kind of been happening in New Zealand music for a while, eh? But it's fantastic to see the public really happy to go and see New Zealand movies and celebrate them. And the trick for us is to keep the momentum going next year.
Oh, that's right. And I mean, you're in a position to do that with the latest film that's been announced. Although 6 days doesn't seem to be as... I mean, it isn't a New Zealand film in the same way that... I mean, obviously in the same way that The Deadlands is. But do you consider it to be a New Zealand production?
Well, I consider myself to be a New Zealand filmmaker, and obviously we'll be looking to work with a lot of New Zealanders on that. So, you know, I'd love to find a way where we can, you know, I think one of the fantastic things about the broad, diverse range of films that have been celebrated this year is that it's just that, the diversity. You know, we don't feel like we have to... You know, on the one hand, you've got The Deadlands, which is very clearly subject matter, a film about Aotearoa, about New Zealand, but then you've got, you know, a movie about vampires. It's just as strongly a New Zealand movie. So, I would love to see that range diversify even more.
Indeed. And talking of diversity, you're turning into a bit of a genre buster. Is there, you know, did you think that when you were ripping tickets at Village in Auckland that this was the sort of career that you had in front of you, that you would just be this go-to guy for dance documentaries and Māori martial arts action?
Well, I'm not sure so much that I foresaw the dance film, but certainly the kind of movies that were on at the movies when I worked there in the mid-90s, like Heat, Casino, Braveheart, you know, there's a very direct lineage back to those movies in terms of their inspiration on the Deadlands. So it was actually a very cool place to kind of train. We had to go in at the end of the movie, you know, 5 minutes before the credits rolled in order to open the doors. So I had always seen the last 5 minutes of every movie before I saw the whole movie, and it's actually kind of really interesting exercise that, you know, you're always watching the movie with objectivity in a way that you wouldn't if you didn't know the ending.
Mm. The Deadlands has been screened at the London Film Festival, as well as the Toronto Film Festival. What's been the reaction from international audiences who perhaps don't have as many ways in as New Zealanders will have?
Humbling, really. I had a similar experience with Number Two, the play, when we showed it at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival and all around the world. You know, this was when it was at the start of my career, where I had written and Madeline performed a very specific story about a very specific culture and specific place. And we were really surprised at the way that people from all over the world got the story. And it's the same with the Deadlands. And interestingly, I think that international audiences so far have been able to celebrate the Deadlands more for the fact that it's in Te Reo than they might have if it was in English.
You didn't write The Deadlands. As a writer yourself, how do you work when you go into something that's been written by somebody else? How do you find your way into it?
For me, it's always about personal connection, and for me, the personal connection on something like Dean Stanley, which again I didn't write, was a little more tricky than it was on The Deadlands. For me, The Deadlands was really easy to connect to. I mean, for a start, it was about a very attractive idea to work alongside a whole bunch of guys my age, or, you know, sort of my generation, and create a sort of atmosphere that was, you know, reminiscent of the kind of sort of teenage things that we would do back in the day when we dreamed of making movies and did our Arnold Schwarzenegger impressions and all that kind of stuff, you know. But also I really identified with the, you know, and so in the same vein, really, I identified with James Rolleston's character, with Hongi, you know, a young teenage boy growing up with the aspiration, asking questions about masculinity and where he fits into the world and all of that. And I also really identified with the Lawrence Mukwadi's character, you know, this dissolute sort of outcast guy on the edge of town with some sort of important backstory.
Mm.
And, you know, I'm just on a kind of totally serendipity sort of level. You know, the idea of doing a film about warriors in Māori, and therefore the warriors all referring to each other as Toa, which obviously means warrior in Māori and in Samoan. You know, I have always had the name Toa. You know, I grew up with it in England as a kid, and for me it was, you know, I felt very special to have that name, but at the same time felt very lonely. I didn't know any other Toa, And certainly there were no taller in the Indiana Jones and James Bond movies that I was watching growing up as a kid. So to be able to make a movie about Tor is a pretty special thing.
And, yeah, it's a pretty special movie. You've mentioned in some interviews some of the influences that you brought to the movie. Apocalypse Now was a really interesting one, I thought, thematically as well as sort of tonally. But, you know, when I was watching the film, it felt to me like I was watching something that had inherited the DNA of the great samurai movies of the 50s and 60s. It felt Japanese at times.
Thank you. Yeah, and that's really Glenn Standring's inspiration. You know, all of the samurai movie thing was very much in the script when I first read it. And not only that, but, you know, westerns. And I always liked the idea that Kurosawa and John Ford and George Lucas, you know, there's this kind of conversation between westerns and western cinema and the cinema of Japan over the generations.
The film isn't a history lesson. Could it be used in that way? I mean, I was going to ask you about the anthropology of it. I mean, how accurate is the film culturally and historically?
Look, there was a way to make the Deadlands that was a lot more kind of, you know, historically accurate. And I think maybe if it had been made here 10 or 20 years ago, it would have, you know, by a different filmmaker, might have been a very different angle. But, you know, I was a kid of the 70s and 80s, as was Matthew Metcalf, the producer, and Glenn, I guess. So, you know, we were all really inspired by, you know, Die Hard and Lethal Weapon as much as anything. So we were kind of determined to make a cool movie more than anything else. And really that's also grown out of things like My Time, you know, the TV show in the 90s, and things like MyFM, and the way that we have found a language to, you know, say, you know, the classic thing is called Tekorido, and I liked the idea of being kind of aligned with the Tekorido process. And in fact, Scotty Morrison, who did the translation and who is like really, really steeped in Māori tikanga and language, obviously, you know, one of the first things he said to me when we were talking about working together on it was that, no, it's just got to be cool. And, you know, really identified with that. Yeah, he's a guy that grew up watching Bruce Lee movies, so. One of the trickiest things for me as a director was, you know, working with a whole bunch of guys that knew all these film references that they thought these scenes should be like. You know, because we've all practiced these stories in our childhood and teenage years, as I said.
Yeah. A few weeks ago, I interviewed Cliff Curtis for this show, and I asked him what he thought the most significant change in the industry had been since he joined it. And he had to think about it for a little while, and then he said that he thought it was that the powers that be had finally worked out that the great stories were to be found in Māoridom. And it seems to me that, you know, the a lot of the greatest New Zealand films, the ones that we're really going to put up in the pantheon, have those roots. I'm going to put the question to you as well. You haven't been around quite so long, but what do you think is the biggest change that you've seen since you started making films?
This is a tricky question for me. Because obviously I just do what I do and sort of, you know, I think possibly from an actor's perspective, that question's easier to answer because they work more often, you know. But from my point of view, the trickiest sort of moment was, you know, around the time of the global financial crisis when, it really did feel like the whole movie business was changing, and you know, I was in England at the time and was really aware that everybody suddenly got very depressed in the film industry and was anxious that the kind of middle scale movies were not going to get made. It was either going to be huge big blockbusters or tiny, tiny little things. But I think one of the things that has been encouraging over the last couple of years is the reemergence of the medium sort of level films. But certainly I feel like, my experience is relatively limited, but it does feel like we went through and possibly still are in a patch where crews have been asked to do stuff that they've been used to getting paid better for relatively little, and I think we've got to be careful of that.
Yeah. One more question before I let you go, and it's about your partner in crime, Matthew Metcalf, who seems to have the wonderful magical ability to get stuff made. Mm. I mean, what's it like working so closely with him?
Well, you know, Matthew and I have made three films, and we're about to embark on a fourth together, and we're both of a similar generation. In fact, Matt worked at Village 8 for, I think, 4 years prior to me. So we come from a similar place, although very, very different people. We've got a lot in common, and I'm really grateful for the opportunity to work with a guy, as you say, who manages to get stuff made. But the other really great thing about Matt is that he is such a onto it creative producer. And he has very strong ideas about script and worked very closely, for instance, with Alan Sharp on Dean Spanley. In fact, a lot of the key ideas for that movie were Matt's, including the invention of the Peter O'Toole character, who wasn't in the original book. That was really Matt's invention. So he lets me do my job and I let him do his job, but at the same time he's a very shrewd guide when it comes to the creative process.
You're 2.5 weeks away from opening your new play, so you're sort of embedded in all of that. We mentioned earlier on 6 Days, which was announced at AFM a few weeks ago. When is that going to go into production? Are you going to get a bit of a break, a chance to sort of recharge your creative batteries a little bit?
Well, the play is a little chance to recharge. You know, I was inspired by Sam Mendes making Skyfall and then going on to do a theatre show, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, in London. So, the play is a kind of a holiday, and it's not a holiday, but it's exercising different muscles. But no, we won't be going into production before Christmas, so I'm looking forward to having a summertime in New Zealand.
Toa Fraser, thanks very much for taking the time out to visit with us at Rancho Notorious, and best of luck for the Deadlands. And just remind me the name of the play, and maybe...
Pure and Deep opens on November the 13th, which is the same night as Mariah Carey, easy to remember. I'm always working in the cool shit, so...
And what theatre is it? Is it going to be on
at the Herald Theatre with Mia Blake and Ian Hughes?
Fantastic, good. We got a bit of a plug in for that one as well. So, thanks very much, Tara.
My pleasure, Dan. Thank you.
Judd Altman, what's it been? 7, 8, 9 years?
What happened to Quinn? You guys didn't split up, did you?
She slept with my boss.
Well, that'll do it.
Yes, it did.
Done.
Right. Is it the whole world, or is it just his family?
You need to put a baby in that woman, like, yesterday. Have you had your man parts checked? Since you may have emptied them over the years. My room is next to yours. My room is next to yours.
This is the guy that slept with my wife.
Who are you coming here?
I'm Wendy Altman, bitch! Yeah, that's a princess cut! You guys are idiots, but you're my idiots.
This is where I leave you.
Oh, don't you wish we could just leave it here, though?
Yeah, we could stop if you want. I'll tell you what, this was a film that I was really trying to work up some kind of antipathy towards. I was really, you know, I was going, oh, this is annoying me. No, it's not. Oh, I can't be bothered. You know, it's... it's reminding me a little bit of The Judge in terms of the streetwise new, you know, city guy goes home to his family and the family are all in the country and they're all a bit countrified and they're all unusual and there's, you know, character conflicts, etc., etc. But it was so damn contrived.
Mm.
Wasn't it? I can't remember anything of the plot. You're going to have to do that first.
Well, speaking of contrived, I actually, the official synopsis by Warner Brothers on IMDb is so good and so cheesy, I'm going to read it. When their father passes away, four grown siblings, bruised and banged up by their respective adult lives.
Money that they have. Oh, the poor things.
I'm not making this up. I'm actually reading this. Are forced to return to their childhood home and live under the same roof together for a week, along with their oversharing mother and an assortment of spouses, exes, and might-have-beens. Confronting their history and the frayed states of their relationships among the people who know and love them best, they ultimately reconnect in hysterical and emotionally affecting ways amid the chaos, humor, heartache, and redemption that only families can provide, driving us insane even as they remind us of our truest and often best selves.
I hope that they get really well paid for writing that crap, because that is more creative.
That is an intern right there.
Well, it obviously they're pitching for a bigger job. Aren't they? On that, it's going to go on their CV. Yeah, I wrote the IMDb synopsis for This Is Where I Leave You. I've got a script. Would you like to read it? but seriously, that, I think more work went into that than actually into the film itself.
Hmm. So, the film is directed by Sean Levy.
I hate him.
Who I am ashamed to say is Canadian. He is responsible for The Internship, Real Steel, Date Night, The Night of the Museum films, The Pink Panther, Cheaper by the Dozen.
This is a CV to be conjured with, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
One day there'll be PhDs done on Sean Levy, the auteur, but not now.
Yeah. The thing that I found really interesting about, not about the film, about the marketing campaign for it. Now, I think I may have watched the trailer, but I've sort of given up on trailers in my life, is that it totally skips over the fact, like, it sounds like they get there and they're grounded, but it's a Jewish family and their father's dying wish is for them to sit Shiva for him, which means sitting together, just literally sitting for a week. And people come to the house and speak to them, but they have to stay together. It's a full cast with, like, Jason Bateman, Tina Fey, Adam Driver, Jane Fonda, Rose Byrne, blah, 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 on and on. But not a good comedy does it make. It was really bland, it was really contrived, it was very predictable, and it just was not that amazing. If you want a really sort of, like, not too difficult film to see on a date, yeah, it'd be okay. My roommate said that he found the film was quite sweet. I don't know. I've been going to film festivals for the last 2 months. No,
so are you
4
spoiled,
months.
Is that what you're saying?
I've been ruined, really.
Right. Well, I would say, I mean, I don't hate Jason Bateman. I think that there are times when
he doesn't act though. He's just like Jason Bateman.
Yeah. He's just deadpan. He's deadpan, and all of those performances are from the Bill Murray school of deadpan, and, you know, not everyone can pull that off, and you still need to actually have some material behind it, you know. Tina Fey, I would love to see her.
Tina Fey's so great, but she was just completely underused.
Well, maybe that's what happens when you build an ensemble like this that's full of quite capable people. I mean, Jane Fonda. Maybe when you throw them all into something as thin as this, that everybody feels underused. You know, Timothy Oliphant, who's a great actor. I didn't even realize it was him. You know, he has like 3 scenes and he plays. Spoiler, won't go into it. Can't be bothered anyway. But it's like, really, you're good. Why are you doing this? Or is this one of those summer TV hiatus gigs where all the people who've got regular TV jobs go off and you know,
pays for their holiday.
Yeah, but if you're gonna do that, you should do. If you're gonna do that, do it properly. Do what Vince Vaughn did with that marriage counseling film where it was all in, like, Tahiti. If you're going to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a truly terrible film. But, you know, if you're going to get all your mates together, to have a party for a few weeks. Go to somewhere warm. Yeah, so really disappointing. Well, not disappointing because I probably didn't have great expectations for anyone. But this is where I leave you. Jane Fonda, is she another one that's run out of money? Is that another reason why she's like, because Robert Redford, right? Robert Redford only made like really important films for a long time, and then there was this rumor that maybe some investments went sour, the banking crisis, and he's got Sundance to continue to finance, and you know, nobody knows quite how much money he pours into that, and all of a sudden he's in Captain America. He's going to come to New Zealand next year to do Pete's Dragon. Well, that's the rumor. That's the rumor. So yeah, Redford coming to New Zealand, but. Yeah, I wonder whether a few of these people, these great people who used to have these extraordinary reputations for quality, picking quality, maybe things have gone a little bit south on them. Mm. Of course, if there are any lawyers listening, particularly lawyers for those people, this is entirely speculation on my part and doesn't relate to any kind of factual knowledge whatsoever.
No.
Is there anything else we need to say about
this? No.
do you have two words for it?
My two words for this is where I leave you is leave it.
All right, my two words for this is where I leave you, I can't remember.
That's a good one.
I'm going to save that. I actually should have saved that for a better film. But anyway, this is where I leave you. All right, talking of... talking of anything? Apropos of nothing, actually, we're going to segue into a film that's opening today. This is Thursday in New Zealand, and it's been a golden year for New Zealand on screen and television, specifically in film. The Deadlands is the latest example of that, Toa Fraser's film, and I'm really pleased that he was able to make time to talk to Rancho Notorious, partly because he's not only promoting The Deadlands at the moment, but he's also in the middle of rehearsals for his new play, which is going to be on at the Herald Theatre in Auckland.
Do we need to do a mid-show sign-off?
Yeah, I'm going to. Okay. Yep. Yeah. All right, Toa Fraser, one of New Zealand's top film talents and a top bloke altogether. I don't know if I mentioned this on the show, but a few weeks ago he tweeted, after I'd seen The Deadlands, which we'll review properly at some point, I tweeted how much I'd enjoyed it, and he sent me a photograph because he and I share a love for Bruce Willis and Die Hard, right? So he sent me a photograph from the set of The Deadlands, which was basically him wearing a white t-shirt covered in blood as a corpse with now I have a tire, ha, ho, 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 which is funniest thing ever. Anyway, we're going to leave you now for end of part one, and we're going to leave you with some music from This Is Where I Leave You, all instantly forgettable, and I'm really, really bitter actually about this because none of the songs on the This Is Where I Leave You soundtrack are available as singles on iTunes. You have to buy the whole damn album.
What did you get? Did you go with Coldplay?
No, heck no.
Because every predictable date movie has to have a Coldplay track in it.
Yeah, I didn't do this. This one is, I think, the one that closes the film. Distant Cousins is the name of the band. On Your Own is the name of the song. But yeah, I'm really like, why would you do that? Make people buy the whole album just for one song. And I'm only going to play 30 seconds of it.
Today I take my own advice and make the most of it. Too many times my choices have been guided by my fears. Into the dark and unknown water I will sink or swim. Like a blade of grass reaching for the sun, I'm ready to